Blog Talk Radio.
This is Our Common Ground. Thank you for joining us tonight for Talk That Matters. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you, in truth to power and ourselves. Our Common Ground. And good evening, and thank you for joining us here at Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, your host, and we so welcome you to our broadcast tonight. We think that we have a program agenda that will satisfy you and your need to stay on top of truth and information in a way that feeds your need to be part of our community. Tonight, our co-host is Alpho of the Alpho Show, and we want to thank him for two fabulous hours of talking politics and pushback strategies at the Alpho Show on Blog Talk Radio and the Mo Alpho Show on TruthWorks Network. And we thank him for his pulse in the right stream. Alpha, that's what you have, pulse in the right stream.
I don't know if that's what I got, Janice. I feel like I got something else. I feel like I've caught something. I took me a small nap and I woke up and I'm feeling rather, I don't know, shaky.
Well, let's tell our listeners what we have on tap tonight. In the first hour, we'll be talking with author Jamal Ali. He is the author of The Fireheart Rendezvous. It is a trilogy, three books, intriguing, that takes us on a journey of our African selves, that helps us to tap into this ancient memory, this spot that's inside all of us, since we can't seem to recognize it. What Jamal Ali has done is written an ancient tale in a love story. And we'll be talking with him about the Fireheart Rendezvous trilogy. And Alpha, I'm very excited. I did finish reading the first two books, and I think I'm like 56 pages away from the end of the third book, and I had promised Jamal that I would finish before we talked today, but last night I could have finished, but I really, really did not want to, I didn't want to let go. And that's the sign of a good book. And this was the third book in the three-part series. In our second page, we're going to be talking tonight about America in Crisis. We're going to be providing for the background for the second page will be the special comments made by Keith Olbermann on Wednesday night following the tax compromise announcement and press conference held by President Barack Obama and what it means. And we need to pull it apart and figure out what it means on our side of the dial. One of the things that Keith Olbermann does, Alpha, and I know that you listen to the commentary, one of the things that he does is he speaks for a base. And my question tonight in our second hour is, are we the base that he is speaking for? So it's going to be a really, really interesting to see how many people join in on the sentiments expressed on behalf of the progressive and liberal base, political base of America. We thank you for being with us here tonight. If you would like to join our listening audience in our chat room, you can do so by joining them at blogtalkradio.com/OCG. We really do encourage you. We have very good, solid exchange going on in our chat room each Saturday evening at our common ground. And it's, again, blogtalkradio.com/OCG. So let's get started, folks. We thank you very much. The Voxor is in our chat room. Dr. Don Alfo is going to be, of course, participating, and we'll see where we go here at Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves.
Beholden to no king, at war with no nation, we became spine to the cultures of the Albion Crescent. No one ever knew our numbers. Relied upon, revered, housed in the architecture of myth, soon no one knew what to believe or expect till we could safely travel alone in all but the worst grottos. We became vehicles of justice.
Tonight, at Our Common Ground, the Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy, the author, Jamal Ali, intrigue of memories in an ancestral spirit, journey in memories, and the power of love, channeling and traveling over ancient waters, ancient sands, and ancient times. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for joining us here at Our Common Ground as we talk about three books which may be the power of ourselves discovering ourselves, with the author, Jamal Ali, the Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy.
Just heard Jamal Ali, the author of the Heart Fire Rendezvous Trilogy, reading from the second book, The Crossing. Let me tell you a little about the book. It is a story quite crafted in our literary experience. The three books recraft our understanding of human history. It is far more than a love story. It is an adventure of fulfilling destiny, engaging purpose, woven with several cultural threads and tapestries across landscapes some myths do not know. The story is contained in three separate epics. Book one, the title is Destiny. Book two, the title is The Crossing. Book three, Culmination. The stories are fast-moving. They are embodied in enthralling entries and have been described as a Mott-centered Lord of the Rings, a story for the peoples of the tropics rather than the people of the North. Ali's writing style is a little Marlonesque rhythm, and you will note tonight that I will play a lot of Bob Marley. It soothes both the most simplistic approach to love and history. It embraces the more complex mind-seeking to explore the mysticism and power of the golden fabric woven through time and souls. These books, this story, is about memory. Us remembering and carrying from one life to another the magic and power of our African spirit. What this author does is he brings the best of Intoshaki Shange's relearning knowledge to Octavia Butler's challenge to believe the unbelievable based on newly processed knowledge. We see through time in these books the eyes of ancient cultures, and we taste destiny as more than a fragrance for the mind. We begin to remember hidden stirrings within ourselves, those moments of wonder and connection linking us to the planet instead of the world. Let me try to give you a very brief overview about the story. This is a book you are going to, these are books you are going to want to read. If you are any way a fan of science fiction, here is your Africanness in its science. Drawn together, this is a story, and this is the way it starts. At a dinner party, in a lush summer garden, you know, get the picture, Mongolia and mimosa, tendrils of Brazilian music connect two people, in Nadara and Olduvai. Now, one of the things that you have to do, it's something that everyone has to do if you don't speak an African language, is you have to get the names of the characters straight. Once you get that, it's almost like you bond with them. And they are together at this dinner party, and they're triggering some memories that they didn't know they had. And I really, as I was reading it, thought that these were memories sheltered in DNA. You know, like it's one of those things that you know, but you do not know. You don't know where it came from. A glimpse of something, some event, some person. And when they meet, Inandara is introduced to Dupa's youngest daughter. And this confluence of lifetimes and floods of memory begin to overwhelm them. And through the three epic stories, we watch intrigue in the spirit and history of many characters, as though we are watching our growing African selves discovering the secrets of truth and justice, and calling on us to truth and universal order. The stories take place from Pacific Palisade, California, where the journey begins, through the Amazon, and the final place of storytelling with the epic culmination, which book three is called, the title is Culmination, in a showdown across the Nile from Abu Simbel. These stories and the lives within the book will transform you, and it will seal your new African self, how you think about your African self. I do want to say that in some very rich detail. If you want to know, if you want to know landscape, geography, and how it plays in our history, this author, Jamal Ali, takes us into layers of tropical human civilizations, which are thick with spirit and ritual and science and magic and powers which really have no name. He also takes us into systems of wisdom and knowledge which are carefully woven, linking, overlaying, and inclusive by paradigm. We discover niches of history often overlooked. And you'll find out when we talk with Jamal Ali why he has been able to have the power and the knowledge to bring this to us in a book of science fiction. The things that we learn, the eyes, we see through the eyes of ancient cultures, and we taste destiny, and it becomes tangible to the reader. It's alluring. It's compelling. And I came away, and when I read, when I wrote my review of this book, which you can find at ourcommonground-talk.ning.com and all of my other sites, in reading these books, I understood how so much I still grieve the loss of Octavia Butler and more, and want more of her. But these three books, really avenge my passion for reading just the mundane, the regular old detective stories, or the girl falls in love and the man cheats on her, or whatever else we might be reading that is so mind-numbing. This is real storytelling in these books. I want to tell you a little about the author, and you should know that I have known Jamal Ali for nearly 15 years. He is also known as Kathera. He is an eclectic blend of independent scholar, historian, artist. By profession, he's a design engineer. He is an esotericist. He has taught and lectured across the U.S. on topics ranging from the sacred architecture of the Nile Valley civilizations, including their sciences, arts, and symbolic languages. He will tell us more when he joins us in a few seconds how he has come to the intersection of modern technology and ancient wisdom systems, Ogun, in the 21st century. The connection between Odu and digital technology is a piece that he is writing, that he wrote in 2008. He has also made several contributions to the Encyclopedia of Vernacular Architecture of the World, and we'll have to ask him what that is, because I don't have a all I know is I fell in love in the way that he has brought us heart fires. He has brought them to us in a way that we understand them, we see them, and we know that they belong to us. I will give you during this broadcast information as to how you can purchase a copy of the Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogies. There is a website, and it's www.HeartfireRendezvous.com. And if you register and log in, it earns you a $7 credit when you purchase the full trilogy altogether. And I have been told by Jamal Ali that there will be more extras on that website. There is also a Facebook page, and we'll give you information about that. And Our Common Ground so much thanks Jamal Ali for agreeing to be with us, and we welcome him to our airwaves. Jamal, thank you so much for being with us, my brother.
Well, I appreciate you having me, BJ. This is a very propitious event for me, and with that kind of intro, I couldn't be happier, so thank you.
Well, you know that I have been very anxious because start off by telling our audience how these books were your own journey.
Well,
how did it start?
I think that's absolutely true. There's a number of, in my opinion, key quirks or anomalies that have been a ongoing part of the experience of writing this work. I started writing it a month after I escaped from Baltimore, after I moved to Houston. But when I first wrote it, I only wrote, maybe 8 pages at the most, and I didn't do anything with it for a year and a half. And the next time I sat down, I wrote like maybe 30 pages, but it was poetry. Now, I had written long poetry before, but not this long. This was the longest. When I wrote that second section, because of what came up, I immediately knew that I was onto something a lot bigger. I didn't know it was going to be as big as it turned out, but I knew I was onto something bigger, and it just grew from there.
Now, for those of us who don't write beyond legal briefs, how do you begin to construct a story that tries to bring together culture, a picture of history, a picture of ancient civilizations and the paradigm that it means for the people who are going to read the story? How did you come up with who was the first character?
Well, the first character is Oldupai. And for people who may think it's similar, it is similar to the area that is generally known as Old Divide Gorge, V with like Victor, but the actual indigenous spelling is with a P like Paul. And it is the lowest spot. It's like the Death Valley of Africa. It's the lowest spot on the continent, which is where his name comes from. But what I would say to answer your question about how something like this comes together, it's really rooted in my childhood, because the stuff that you're talking about bringing to the story, I bring to the story because that is a part of who I am. My father raised me in the ancient Egyptian tradition. My father was a Mason. He was a school teacher, but he also wrote poetry. So that naturally, and I'm the oldest, so that naturally put me in a place where, as a person, as a guy, as a young black man growing up, I graduated from high school in 71, so I was a child of the 60s and a lot of stuff that was going on. Having your father be a poet puts a whole bunch of types of personal expression in a place that is accepted, especially considering how much of an alpha male my father was. So it just changes things. So growing up and being raised in the ancient Egyptian tradition, how do I say this? Some of your listeners may have heard of a book called by George G.M. James, and it's called Stolen Legacy. It's a masterwork in the field for 50 years almost. Well, I read that when I was 9 years old, so I had a very different life experience around what it means to be African versus what it means to be black. My father was principal at the University of Islam and Temple No. 1 in Detroit in the mid-50s when I was, before I even started school. That was his level of involvement. So he was also involved in a group called the Pan-African Student Union, where a lot of African students came together to coordinate things. Well, most of the stuff that he was doing was happening in like the 50s, early 60s. So you're saying like 58 to 62, 63. That was a time when all of the independence wars were going on in Africa, in Ghana and Togo and Benin, Nigeria, all these different countries were breaking off from their colonial rulers during this time and regaining their land. It was neocolonialism and all that stuff, but they had control back. Same thing with India. So by the time I was in high school and we're in the civil rights black power movement, that movement to me is like a second stage, where for most kids in my age group, this was all new stuff. Well, if you've been involved with people who were fighting with tanks and weapons and shooting back at white people to gain control of their land and they win, then that takes things to a whole different place. So when you come back to the U.S. and now you're talking about civil rights and all the rest of this, the idea of winning is not foreign to you. It's like, okay, you know, we got a shot. We just got to have the right tactics and the right strategy. So I'm just saying to you that for me, because of how I grew up, my sense of cultural foundation was always much more African than anything else. Yes, I'm connected and I studied to a couple of Native American systems, but that's only appropriate since this is their land. But I'm just saying it's the mix has been there. So I've been writing seriously since I was in college, whether it was poetry, prose, stage play, screenplay, journalism, whatever. So I've been writing for a long time. So it's just really a matter of craft and having the foundation to craft from.
When you say that you were brought up in a home where you were essentially reared in an Egyptian culture, how does that play out in the United States? Where was this?
Well, truth be told, that's really only half the story. Okay, that's really only half the story. I wasn't trying to get into a whole lot of personal detail here, but what I will say is that when my parents married, when they were in college, both my parents were Christian. After they got married, my father converted to Islam. So my father was a street kid from Cleveland. My mother was from the farm in Kentucky, and they met at Kentucky State. But when he converted, this was, like, obviously a real big issue. So there was a lot of little infighting and stuff that went on, me being the firstborn and all the rest of that, between them over this religious, cultural, spiritual issue. So the best way I could describe it is to say it was like growing up in Beirut, you know, and it was full-scale war. It wasn't a joke. It was full-scale war. And it's inside the family. Well, you got to – that's part of what the 60s was. It was just – what happened in the family was a microcosm of what was happening in the society. So, you know, I've always been that way. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if somebody invited me to some kind of outdoor fundraiser event connected to help publicize this, and we had a little softball game, I could play. I'm older and all the rest of that, but, you know, I've been an athlete all my life, so I'm functional. So the same thing is true of writing, or the same thing is true of cooking. For people who love to cook, you know, going in the kitchen and throwing a three-course thing together because you have a taste for something really good and you can make it really well, that's a no-brainer. That's fun. But for people who don't cook, that's like an enormous task. The same thing is true with writing. If there's something that you do and comes comfortably to you and you are committed to craft, then it's the same kind of process.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a number of very intriguing characters going on in these three books. And it's very clear in reading the books that as you build the bridges from one part of the journey of the two major characters into another part of the journey, that you're hitting on some very clear cultural, spiritual, and historical themes. How do you summarize those?
Wow, that's a big question. If I had to summarize them, I would summarize them in three, meaning that there are three types of those kinds of stories within the trilogy. One of those kinds of stories is a story that happens often where during the traveling, the cadre, you know, it's dinner time, whatever, and somebody says, oh, okay, so we haven't heard from you yet. How did you first meet Ogunir? And they go, oh, the first time? Oh, let me see. And then now we hear a story about ancient China or the Olmecs or, you know, Micronesia. So many tens of thousands of years ago when so-and-so was happening. So now we have a glimpse into time and culture that is, you know, taking us into not just places but intersections. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that that I was mentioning to somebody earlier. There's a lot of, what would I call it? Because I have a background in scholarship in African studies, my approach is different. Because I have an engineering background, my approach from a science technology approach is different. Because I'm a spiritual mission in, I think it's safe to say, two systems of traditional African religion, I bring that to the conversation. So there is a precision, there's a rigor, there's a science, there's a expansiveness to it. All of that's just part of how it manifests to me. I don't see that as so much a matter of me wielding, but so to characterize again, number one is those stories about time in the past. Number two, it's stories or plot lines that deal with principles or circumstances that we have to face up to. And that's actually a bad pun, but one of the key elements of this story has to do with faith and appearance and how we deal with our appearance and how we engage as people of color, not just Africans, but all tropical people who have been identified as the other by this particular group that's supposed to be in charge. So we are the other, and we are characterized as other rather than intrinsic. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole lot of things that go along with that. This story doesn't do that. This is a story that, to me, takes a very important step that we used to talk about a lot back in the day, and that is, regardless of how you want to look at it, whether you want to look at it as tropical people collectively, African people, Asian, from the Americas, Pacific Islands, when it really comes down to it as human beings, if you can engage with who you really are in consciousness and spirit and energy, it's not really about what anybody else is doing to you. It's not about constraint that somebody's putting on you. It's not about repression and oppression and all the things that are being done. What really matters is what you do with that. If you let that get in your head, if you let that break your spirit, you're going to be in big trouble. But you do have a choice. You have a choice to flex and exert and assert yourself in a way to counteract that. in the same way that if you were caught in a flood or a landslide, you're going to try to do things to keep your head above ground. Now, you may not be making progress of getting better and getting free, but you are not being overwhelmed. And I think that when you look at the circumstances that we're facing in this country right now, economically, infrastructure-wise, across the board, that is a level of success that people are going to have to recognize. The fact that you may be off your feet, but you are not overwhelmed, is a survival gift in these times. And part of what I talk about in this piece deals with some of the things we need to address. So, the second category.
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you say that, because I was thinking, I was watching Senator Bernie Sanders filibustering on the House floor the other day, and I was thinking about Olga Nuri. And it had to do with, where did Sanders get his robust passion? And in your story, you have men who not only have a robust passion, they know where the source of it. And that's where the memory channeling is so intriguing in the book. And I hated to, there are lessons. There are lessons for us to translate in this book, for us to learn to translate, to look back. It's almost like the concept of Sankofa.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. Go back and get it and bring it into the now and apply it in the now to help yourself. Because as long as it remains a simple historical reference that is on the shelf, whether it's on the shelf on your wall or the shelf in your mind, it is not dynamic. It is not functional. It's inert. And what we need to do is to take that knowledge and that understanding and make it functional and active and dynamic in our lives, manifesting change and strength and protection. That's what this is really about.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. Our guest in this first page is Jamal Ali. He's the author of the Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy. And it is three books that not only teach us, it helps us to tap into the spirit of honoring what we bring forth and where it came from. And I can't tell you. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Jamal Ali about the Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy, and we'll take your calls at 347-838-9852. One of the things that I do want to impress before we go to break is that these three books really, I feel like, because I started reading them before publication or right at publication, I feel like I'm part of the great tradition of African-American literature. It was for me, it has been like having read the trilogy written by Octavia Butler before it went to press. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. 347-838-9852 is our number, and our guest, Jamal Ali. And we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more about this wonderful book and this author and what it means to tap into our source of both memory, to honor the spirit that perhaps we have lost but can find. We'll be right back.
In the ancient Egyptian tradition, both my parents were school teachers, and I have been a scholar in the field of ancient civilizations and cultures this is 2010, for close to 30 years.
Yeah.
I've given lectures at different parts of the country. I've contributed to encyclopedias on Encyclopedia of Vernacular Architecture of the World. I'm an engineer by profession, but I'm also an initiate in the system of Ifa, which is the spiritual system of the Yoruba of Western Nigeria and Benin. So between that and being an engineer by profession, there's a number of areas that I have background in that I draw on to craft this story. It's a brief aside, but it's worth mentioning that when I first came to California and I was going to UCLA, I took a class with Dr. Thelma Moss. It's called The Probability of the Impossible, and one of the lecturers spoke about something called retrogressive hypnotherapy, where they put you into a trance and take you back in time.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds kind of hokey, but the thing that really bore this out was one of the people that she worked with turned out to have been on the staff of Abraham Lincoln and remembered the location of some papers that no one knew about.
Yeah.
And as a result of that trance, she gave information that people were able to use to find previously unknown papers of Abraham Lincoln.
Is that right?
So there was a...
downhill fast. Everybody was on my case. Now, I kept hoping that life would change real soon. I knew drinking too much messed up my life. A friend suggested I check out AA. It worked. I found myself in an AA group. Finally, I've got my act together. Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. Look us up, check your phone book, newspaper, or AA.org.
Common Ground. Thank you for staying with us over our break and for joining us. And if you'd like to join us in our chat room, you can do so blogtalkradio.com/OCG. Our guest tonight, Jamal Ali. He is the author of the Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy. Jamal, thank you so much again for joining us at Our Common Ground. I want to talk a little about, I think it's very important for people to understand that this is no ordinary book. I know I sound like Sade, No Ordinary Love. It is a love story which encapsulizes the whole notion of our capacity, of the possibilities of us tapping in to our ancient selves. Why did you decide, two questions, why did you decide to make it, you know, one of the things you do is you lay out the landscape of our history, both geographically as well as historically in the sense of, you go through, I mean, I have this picture in my mind as I was reading that there were seasons. I learned so much about the African landscape why did you decide to put this in the context of a love story, which also teaches us how to love outside of intimacy, but with intimacy? You get what I'm saying?
Well, can I go over that last part again about
that
intimacy?
You're teaching us our African capacity and how generous and what a treasure that is. You are teaching us not only history, but you're teaching us landscape.
Okay.
I would have never been able to go on these journeys but for these characters. But I see them not only loving in an intimate way, but learning how to love as family.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying now. If I'm getting what you're asking me, I would say that what you are touching on is a very important element of the whole premise of Heartfire Rendezvous, which is why I talk about it in tropical terms, why the settings are in tropical places on the planet consistently throughout across time.
Mention some of the places where the journey takes us.
Book one, each book has three parts. So part one is in Pacific Palisades, which is on the coast in L.A. Part two and three take place in the Amazon at the foot of the Andes, deep into the headwaters. In book two and three, most of it takes place in Africa, but the Anandar and the children are still in L.A. When they leave in book three to fly to Cairo to come down the river to meet the cadre, then everything is happening in Africa. But that's everything that's happening in the present day. There are elements of Angkor Wat, Angkor Thom in Cambodia, the Inca, the Olmec, Namadal, the Micronesia, the Black Thai, China, definitely India, the ancient Dravida, we're talking about African civilization before the arrival of the Aryans and Hinduism, which is a very different cultural situation. There's a lot of stuff that's dealt with Native Americans, particularly in the plains and in the U.S. So there's Pacific Islanders involved, there's North, South, Central America, Africa. Really about the only place that's not really touched on in Heartfire Rendezvous is Australia. But in a way it is, because one of the members of the cadre by the name of Elohim is a Maori, and he's from New Zealand.
That's right.
And New Zealand and Australia are side by side, so I think I could argue that he represents that whole area. So,
Now tell us a little about, I don't want to give the whole story away, and I hope that all of you who are listening will purchase the Heartfire Rendezvous trilogy, and you can find it at heartfirerendezvous.com for Kwanzaa gifts for your family and friends. It would be a wonderful thing. But Jamal, very briefly, I don't want to run out of time before I hit all the points that I wanted to get with you about on this book. But tell us about why you decided to write it in the style that you wrote.
Okay. Before I say that, let me make a couple of things clear, because you've announced this a couple of times. I need to make this clear. Right now, the two best places for information on Heartfire Rendezvous Adventure Trilogy is the blog, which is heartfirerendezvous.wordpress.com, and is the Facebook page, which is just, if you're on Facebook, just do Heartfire Rendezvous, Heartfire is one word, and do a search and it'll take you right to the page. So there's links to videos and information, the discount stuff and all the rest of that. The website, heartfirerendezvous.com, is not up yet. And the goal is to launch next week, but, you know, there's been some setbacks, so I don't want people to be looking for that.
So it's Hardfire Rendezvous. WordPress.
Hardfire Rendezvous.wordpress.com.
Right.
Right. Okay.
And I posted that in the chat room.
Okay. And the other thing is that you can, if you go to either one of those places, the Facebook page or Hardfire Rendezvous, there are links there that will take you directly to my e-store on Amazon where you can get the books directly. So if so that's the other reason. So all of the announcements and everything will be primarily through those two means, and then once the website launches, then everything will be up for grabs. Because there's a lot, there's resources
on there. Now, can you go directly to Amazon and pick it up?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Yes, you can. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about how you decided the style. It's poetry style. For those of you who are, I know that there are many of you who are going to pick this book up right away. I can't wait to finish book three, which I did not finish because I didn't want to let go. Now that's a problem that you created for me, Jamal. I did not. Last night I could have finished Culmination, but I didn't want to let go. I didn't want for it to end.
Well, first of all,
and I didn't want to spend my entire weekend trying to unravel myself from three books.
Well, first of all, I think that's the highest compliment that a person can get, is that, especially
and you're
after
talking
that
to
length.
Someone who reads at least 100 fiction books a year. And I read Octavia Butler, at least 4 or 5 of her works every year. I reread it and reread it because I want more and more, and now she's dead, and I won't get any more than I've got. And here you come with the Hardfire Rendezvous trilogy, and I will be doing that for years.
Well, thank
because
you.
Because you know what people do with intriguing characters like this, and you put into this book some intriguing ideas, things that people won't think about by themselves. And I think I have a pretty creative mind, but there are events in these journeys. I wouldn't have thought of that. That's how I feel about it.
Well, yeah, there are, and I just think that there are some things, again, when you ask me to characterize the story, the second category of the story would be things that are things we need to face, like I was talking about our appearance. And one of the things that I deal with in Hardfire Rendezvous, which to me is a very important issue, is the practice of using child soldiers in West Africa. Now, I'm not saying that's the only place that it has happened, and we know who introduced it. We're not going to get into that conversation. Well, my point is that as far as I know, that is the only place on the planet where people do that. And what's unique is that it's one thing to be a child soldier in Beirut, in Palestine, where you're fighting for your people. You know what I'm saying? But in West Africa, they go and they kidnap children from these villages, and then they bring them into an area that they have nothing to do with and force them to fight and kill people that they have no dispute with. And they get exposed to all of these horrors. And then when they're done, they just get sent home. And how do you expect them to have any kind of healthy impact on their community? So I just think that it's an issue that, you know, is one of those things we just don't talk about enough, you know, because not just because of what it is and what happens, but what does it mean that there isn't some part of us that is screaming, saying, no, this cannot happen. We cannot do this. This is like the stupid HIV rape thing that they do in South Central Africa, like it's going to get rid of the disease or something. No, we can't have this. And I think that that's a big part of what the story is, like the segment that you played from the video by the Ajikebu, because the presence of that kind of strength in your environment makes everything better and peaceful, because the people that take advantage of weakness can't function in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, if you've ever lived in an environment where strength was part of your experience, then it changes how you deal with life completely. Now, that sounds very general, but let me give you a real specific example. When I was growing up in Detroit during the 60s, the Detroit riot was the worst of all of them. The Detroit riot was the only riot that lasted 7 days and required the call out of the regular army. National Guard came out for everybody else. They had to put an army in Detroit. Now, what am I saying? What I'm saying is that there was no defeat. It was a standoff, first of all. Second of all, after that, whenever there would be a time where some kid got shot by the cops and, you know, the report, everything made it clear it was a bad shoot, this and the other, we didn't have any, like, police commission counsel to make those decisions. It was handled like everybody else handled everything else. What's the difference? The difference is that if nothing happened to that officer and they were, like, put on death duty or whatnot, sometime in the next 2-3 weeks or whatever, there would be a police call and some cop would go out somewhere in a warehouse or got called about something and they get shot. And nobody would say anything at first. Next couple of days, there might be some rumblings about this being connected to what happened before, and the cops would get crazy and start doing a bunch of wild stuff, but it wouldn't have any effect. And it was just real simple. You take one out of you take one of yours.
Mm-hmm. I want to play a bit of that area from book two where you read some of the material that deals with that. This is Jamal Ali, author of the Heart Fires Rendezvous trilogy.
Shreds and threads of the divine we are, and once remembered, all is possible. The voice introduced a new form of travel with stones of power and light. Sitting atop our stallions, fully provisioned, the animals fidgeted, then calmed as rhythms emerged. We were surrounded by wind, so fierce you couldn't see, but not even our sand scars rippled. Violet, static lightning rose in a cylinder around, and suddenly, everything stilled. It was yet early in the afternoon, but we were far out of sight of any city. Sadaka was there and recognized the oasis a short jog away. Sadaka's brewing smile leavened into a grin and broke into a laugh. You're right, I do remember. It was one of those oases we had long used on treks toward the Albion. The Albion? Yes, he nodded. The Albion Sea, covering much of what is now the Sahara. I recognized the oasis because once, out riding to stop a war, we found it was a good 2 days' hard gallop from the temple of our home. Amazement flooded them. Eye contact, water sparked ignition. Once we knew we could travel this way, Elohim continued, no dream of a flying carpet could catch us. The voice was weakened, but he rode like the rest of us. We were now fugitives, too dangerous to leave alone, too powerful to kill by force. Elohim paused, slowly scanning the core of the group. Where there is no law, force and treachery dominate. But we walked strong in the open, and people soon discovered our code and cadre became cultural immune system. Tyranny diminished. Thieves and slavers soon left the area. Beholden to no king, at war with no nation, we became spine to the cultures of the Albion Crescent. No one ever knew our numbers. Relied upon, revered, housed in the architecture of myth, soon no one knew what to believe or expect, so we could safely travel alone in all but the worst grottos.
Jamal, one of the reasons that I wanted to play that is, first of all, to thank you for recommending the Bob Marley piece as background for reading the book, because it gives it a cadence, a rhythm that puts the story It's almost like having a movie in your head while you're reading. That's how I felt about it.
I get that a lot. Let me tell you something that's very interesting about this. First of all, Bob Marley and I share the same birthday. Secondly, that song, Natural Mystic, is my favorite Bob Marley song. And when I was writing the story, and you get to the end of book one, and he's stretched out on the table as Anandara and Ashanti walk away, and he starts sending out this signal on the ethers, this gets made into a series of movies, that is the music that would be playing when he's sending out that signal, because that's what I heard when I was writing.
You know, for those of us who really have a sense that there is a connection with our ancestors, this notion, this idea that you build in the book of sending thoughts and memories across ethers was just so fascinating to me as a lover of science fiction. And I always have to have a visualization going on while I'm reading, and all stories don't. I think there's a difference between telling a story and being a storyteller, and you are clearly a storyteller. And all I could think about was growing up in Florida, sometimes the heat would be rising from the pavement on the street.
Right.
You know, you could see the
heat. Yeah, you could see the heat rising,
And that's how I built my ether stream while reading.
They're
tremendous stories and journeys in this book, Jamal. And I really do want to thank you for this story. I think black people need these stories.
Well, I think people of the tropics all over the world need these stories.
We need to put into context how the possibility that there is richness and there is, I would say, believability about our connections. Otherwise, we have nothing.
Well, I agree, and I would share this with you about the ethers that you were talking about, the heat waves.
Mm-hmm.
I would remind you about nature, about whales, and how whales, the big sperm whales and the blue whales, are able to communicate halfway around the planet with their cries because of something called ELF, extreme low frequency radio. They're able to send their signal, and it'll carry like from the West Coast to China or the Philippines to communicate with other whales. That's part of how they communicate. So that there is this flow, system of flow and exchange and communion that we exist in that is not simply human, and it is not the world, but it's the planet. And I would say that's a big part of what the discussion, the context of the discussion in Heartfire Rendezvous was all about.
Wow. But let me ask you something. You know, you don't often, I was thinking this morning that, gee, I'm going to have this discussion with Jamal Ali tonight, and it's almost tantamount to having had a discussion with Octavia Butler that I never had, to ask her a number of things about how her brain got hooked into some of those storylines, and I want to ask you how your brain got hooked into some of the concepts and the notions like ether, like memory channeling. Have you had any experience, any direct experiences around some of the things that you present in this in these stories?
Absolutely. I would say to you that when you were talking earlier and I said there's like four or five things about the experience that you said, the journey of writing this trilogy, that are very bizarre and anomalous, And one of those things is that there's a great amount of what I wrote that when I wrote it, I felt like I was writing it from memory. And that was a very eerie feeling. But it's part of what the experience was. I think that the other thing to me that was most amazing is that I wrote this over the span of 15 years. And there were at least two or three times when I didn't touch it for two or three years at a time. So what I'm saying is, while I was writing High Five Rendezvous, I was writing other things. I wrote a novella. I wrote a play. I wrote probably 250 other poems, short stories, essays, different, you know, blog posts. So I was writing a lot of other stuff. But what was weird is that whenever I would go back to High Five Rendezvous and pick it up, as soon as I picked it up and opened it on the computer, bam, I was right back in it like I never left. So there was no disconnect. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, there's portions of High Five Rendezvous that I wrote, major portions, that are completely out of sequence. What is now part 7 and 8 was written, most of it was written before 5 and 6 was written.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think however you got through these stories, that it's going to be a very important, I think that, and I really do hope this, Jamal, that my 9-year-old grandson will have it as required reading in either high school or college.
Well, that's
because
a lofty goal.
I think
goal.
It's there.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's not a goal. I think that if I travel on the ethers, it was meant to be.
Okay.
That
well,
someone was appointed by something to remind us of the pulse and where we find our powers. How to tap into those, how to not be so lonely on this in this world, and to be and to the extent and the depth of which we are part of this planet.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, I'm giving Dick Gregory a copy of the Heart Fire Rendezvous trilogy for Kwanzaa.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Because I think that he would have such an appreciation.
Okay.
You know, Lil will probably have to read it to him while he sits.
Okay.
But I think that he, of all the people that I was thinking about who would value this work, and it really is a literary work. I mean, that he would be the one. But the other is I want you to talk for a second before we really have to go, and I'm extending this beyond the hour. I want you to talk about the science of the stories.
Well, I think the science of the story operates on multiple levels. I think the science of the story operates spiritually, so that we're not just dealing with spookism, we're dealing with spiritual science that's being practiced with precision and understanding and an expansive system-based approach. I think science comes into play relative to dealing with the cultural history of peoples and places and dealing with it from a place of rigor and engagement that doesn't really get dealt with in a story context very often because people don't have that background. I mean, unless you really get into it and you're really proficient at something that is part of your story, then it's not going to really take hold like that. And I think that the last place and one of the most important places where science comes into play is relative to time. And allow me to say that when High Five Rendezvous launches, a big part of what you get through your registration beyond the money premium is that there are resources on the website that deal with a lot of the things we're talking about. So I have a wiki in there that has map links and links to images for flora and fauna and maps and different aspects of non-English glossaries in there, Yoruba English glossaries in there. There's discussion about the whole concept of the soulmate premise, and a lot of those things are going to be on the website for people to engage. Part of it is going to be a wiki, so when people in other parts of the world who are part of, you know, the market and part of people I'm connecting with are in Brazil or Southeast Asia or something, and they go, oh, yeah, he said the K-pop tree. We got a K-pop tree down the street. So they go on and take a picture, they send it in, and then this thing starts to grow. And people who are living or know about Angkor Wat and scholars from Demon will come in and add other information about these different cultures. So now this becomes an expansive resource, you know, for people to get that kind of information. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that's coming down the pipe.
Well, it certainly is a masterful work.
Thank you very much.
It is masterful and it is unique in the sense that it tells our Africanness. It speaks to all of the things that we are told about in a lot of different volumes, but it puts it in a story. And as one of your colleagues described it, it really is the Lord of the Rings for the people of the tropics.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you making that point.
Well, I am looking for, you know, one of the things I was, it's very cold here in Boston, and I was thinking last week as I was reading, gee, I wish that it was a summer day where I could go out and sit outside and have the wind whisper to me as Jamal Ali teaches me, guides me, and takes me on a wonderful, magnificent journey that every African soul ought to take.
Well,
Jamal Ali, thank you so much for this work. It is the Heartfire Rendezvous, 3 books, a trilogy. And we hope that you will join this author in this echo of spirit and heart. We wish you so much luck, and we'd like to have you back as you,
the launch was
last week, and we'd like to hear about how it's going. And for those of you who would like to buy the book, you can go to heartfirerendezvous.wordpress.com. The book, again, is the book. The Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy. You cannot read the book out of order.
She said that. I didn't say that.
You cannot read them out of order. If you do that, you're going to be not confused, but you're going to be lost in a journey, and you'll have to find your way back to start over.
Yeah, I agree. I think you really do need to read it from the beginning because of how the whole situation evolves. But, you know, people are going to do what they're going to do. And
That's right.
Really, really quick, to answer your question earlier, I didn't decide to write it in poetic format. I started writing it because I thought it was a poem. And by the time I got to the second part where it was now like 40-something pages, it was still in a poetic format, but by that time, the format had become part of the style of the story in terms of what it did in visual rhythm and all the rest of that. And early, you know, a good 3-4 years into it, I just decided that I would keep it in that form and not put it in paragraphs. So there are people who try to fuss at me about that, but that's over and done with.
It is indeed done. The Heartfire Rendezvous Trilogy is a story, quite crafted story in our literary experience. The 3 books, take us to our understanding of human history, and it is more than a love story. It is an adventure of fulfilling destiny, engaging purpose, woven with several cultural threads and tapestries across landscapes some myths do not know. It's contained in three separate epics. Book one is Destiny, book two, The Crossing, book three, The Culmination. And we thank you, Jamal Ali, the author, for your contribution. This is a real contribution. Jamal, thank you so very much. And we look forward to having you back at our common ground. And you know that I love you.
I love you, too.
Always have, always will.
All right, girl. Thank you, Bijou.
And, you know, I also thought, if I didn't know Jamal, would I understand this book? Absolutely. But knowing you made it even more adventurous.
Thank you,
my love. And
right,
good luck
care.
To you. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. Our number is 347-838-9852. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about America's political crisis. Alpha of the Alpha Show is my co-host. We've been talking to Jamal Ali. And we'll take your calls when we come back.
As much that is under sea was once dry land. We were Ajikabu, a sect of warrior priests from Sahara, beacon city along the southern sweep of the great Albion Sea. The continent was much different then. The Serengeti was lush, West Africa rich with forests. Kilimanjaro was too hot to have snow. Yet, even then, the Nile was already ancient. Ajikabu dressed completely in black with only their hands, eyes, and feet exposed. Women and men both among us. Our people were from the deep interior of the continent. Our skin a rich indigo, the darkest of black with iridescent blue highlights. Our sect had founded and mastered a spiritual science, fusing martial arts, what is now called yoga, psychic abilities, and an energetic feng shui, which allowed us to shape and wield energy as a sculptor works clay. Exiled for failing to align with a corrupt king, hundreds of us wandered the great flat, leading from sea to vast savanna. Some even ventured as far as the Atlantic, which is not what we called it then. Things were loose on the Great Flat, a series of trade routes and...
You are our mothers, you are our sisters, you are our daughters. AIDS is the leading cause of death for black women ages 25 to 34. But there are things you can do to help.
Prevention is power.
Get educated, get tested, get treated.
Help stop AIDS.
Hi out there, this is Janice Graham of Our Common Ground. Want to remind you of some of the terrific broadcast shows available to all you talkers. The India Declare Show, Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. and Saturday at 11 a.m. The Alpha Show, every Saturday, 3 p.m. And following that 3 p.m. broadcast, he's at TruthWorks Network at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And don't forget of all the audio documentary being provided at TruthWorks Network here at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham, and I'm sure me and my friends will be listening for you. Thank you for being with us here at Our Common Ground. Our lines are open, 347-838-9852. I'm Janice Graham, and I'm listening for you.
Well, show enough to you good.
Tell me something good.
Tell me that you love me, yeah.
Tell me something good.
And tell, we are inviting you to tell us something good at 347-838-9852. We're moving into our second page here at Our Common Ground. We want to talk about, this week has been one political firecracker after another. Did you hear Senator Bernie Sanders filibustering the nation? It was all political theater, but it was wonderful. Alpha, don't you think it was wonderful?
Janice, I think that Bernie Sanders' filibuster should be really burned to a DVD, and it should simply be distributed. Because,
exactly.
I mean, his entire approach to, he covered everything. He covered everything, and there is a huge difference in what he covered and the lies that have been spewed from the other side. You know, people, they criticize me because they say I'm willing to settle for the lesser of two evils. And I know that you cannot count on people on the Democratic side, and you can lump them in with the people on the Republican end. But there is something that is so insidious and nefarious about Republicans and how they go about simply trying to persuade and lie and con through lies and misinformation and just being willfully dishonest. So, you know, I just thought that Bernie Sanders did Friday was just off the hook. And I watched the majority of it, and it was replayed on C-SPAN later in the evening. And it lasted for 8.5 hours, so you can about imagine. But to me, it was epic. To me, it was just epic.
Well, I watched it twice, and I think you're right. You know, one of the things in talking with Jamal Ali about his magnificent book, and for those of you who are listening, I can't tell you how magnificent those three books are. I mean, for black people to read, you know, Alpha, one of the things I was thinking was about history. I think that Jamal Ali's publication of these three books is literary history, and I hope that we take care of it. But getting back to Senator Bernie Sanders, there is a character in the Heartfire Rendezvous trilogy who recalls on the ethers of memory his greatness as a warrior, an African warrior. And he has to speak to, address the issues of justice of the day and the events. And he reminded, and it was going against the grain of everyone else, and it really was putting him in harm's way in the book. And it reminded me, when I saw Bernie Sanders, of how some people are just have warriors. Just have warriors, a warrior spirit. But even before Bernie Sanders began, I want to have our listeners listen to what I thought was the best encapsulation of what the president had done and the response by the progressive and liberal community, people who consider themselves his base. And I want to talk to you about it, 347-838-9852. This is Keith Oberman, the night of the president's press conference.
To paraphrase Churchill again, let me begin by saying the most unpopular and most unwelcome thing that we have sustained a defeat without a war, the consequences of which will travel far with us along our road. We should know that we have passed an awful milestone in our history when the whole equilibrium of American politics and policy have been deranged, and that the terrible words have, for the time being, been pronounced against this administration. Thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. In exchange for selling out a principal campaign pledge and the people to whom and for whom it was made, in exchange for betraying the truth that the idle and corporate rich of this country have gotten unprecedented and wholly indefensible tax cuts for a decade, in exchange for giving the idle and corporate rich of this country two more years to accumulate still more and more vast piles of personal wealth with which they can buy and sell everybody else, in exchange for extending what he spent the weeks before the midterms calling tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires to people who have proven without a scintilla of doubt, without even a fig leaf of phony effort to make it look like they would do otherwise, that they will keep the money for themselves. In exchange for injecting new vigor into the infantile, moronic, disproved for a decade, three-card Monty game of an economic theory purveyed by these treacherous and ultimately traitorous Republicans, that tax cuts for the rich will somehow lead to job creation, even though if that had ever been true in the slightest, the economy would not be where it is today. In exchange for giving tax cuts for the rich, which the nation cannot afford, and extending their vintage through the next election, and thus promising at best a reenactment of this whole sorry, amoral, degrading spectacle during the 2012 presidential campaign, when the sides will be climbing over each other to again extend these cuts. In exchange for this searing and transcendent capitulation, the president got just 13 months of extended benefits for those unemployed less than 100 weeks. And he got nothing, absolutely nothing, for those unemployed for longer, the 99ers. This the administration is celebrating, taking the victims of Republican economic policy, taking the living, breathing proof that the Bush tax cuts for the rich do not create jobs, and putting economic bullseyes on their backs as of next December. On the one hand, unaffordable tax breaks for the beneficiaries of the Bush tax cuts made ever more permanent as they threaten to suck $4 trillion out of government revenues in the next decade. On the other hand, an insufficient, dead-end unemployment solution for Americans who would actually work for a living, a solution made ever more temporary. And we're hearing nothing about those 99ers, even though the numbers of them will balloon from 2 million to 4 million or more by next December, even with this deal. Even though just last Thursday, the president's own Council of Economic Advisors reiterated the reality that the easiest way to create jobs and keep jobs is to make sure that the unemployed continue to have money to spend. The unemployed, unlike the rich, whom this president has just bowed to, are in fact the job creators. They do not have investment portfolios to expand. They do not have vast savings into which to stuff the government checks. They have to spend the money. And the council reported last week that when someone becomes a 99er, his or her household loses at least one-third of its income. And where the 99er was the sole breadwinner, that's four households out of 10, they lose nine-tenths of their income. The economy is surprisingly simple. If business and the rich won't spend and the middle class can't spend, the only factor left to keep pushing money into the insatiable maw of capitalism is the government. So, should the government give the money to the rich who keep it or to the not rich who spend it? Apparently, this president does not know the answer to that question, even though he has his own Council of Economic Advisors. Mr. President, for these meager crumbs you have given up, costly, insulting, divisive, destructive tax cuts for the rich, and you have given in to Republican blackmail, which will be followed by more Republican blackmail. Of course, it's not just tax cuts for the rich that you've given up. There's also your new temporary payroll tax holiday, establishing a precedent that the way money is pumped into Social Security should be negotiated and traded off, and making it just that much easier to gut Social Security later on. And oh, by the way, in the middle of a crisis over making temporary Republican tax cuts permanent, you give the Republicans another temporary Republican tax cut that they can come back later to blackmail you into making permanent. Well, sir, at least that's the end of it. Except, of course, for the estate tax, what Republicans so happily call the death tax, which will be reduced from its 2009 levels. Huh? The money given by one dead rich person to some living rich persons will not be taxed up to $5 million. More than $5 million, and it's 35%, which is less than it was under the tax laws of President Bush's last fiscal year. Sir, You have given undeserved tax breaks, and you have carved them a little more deeply into the stone of law to rich people living and dead. And you want me to tell them which Democrat proposed this estate tax giveaway part? Blanche Lincoln. Blanche Lincoln, repudiated by nearly half the Arkansans in her own party, and then repudiated by 63% of the voters in Arkansas. Mr. President, you're listening to Blanche Lincoln? What? Were Bob Beckel and Pat Caddell unavailable?
Well, I think that Keith Olbermann pretty much summed up what we were hearing, Alpha, across the airwaves from Tuesday until as recent as today.
Well, Janice, what gets
and,
me...
And the question is, does he really speak, even with the savaging criticism, does he really speak to the issues of black people around the compromise, around the direction that this administration has taken, around the issue of whether or not we're even on the table?
Well, absolutely not. And, you know, the first response from this White House was to go on the offensive. Tomorrow's Sunday morning programs, and you know how I've been critical of they aren't enough voices or his surrogates. Oh, he's got plenty of surrogates coming out tomorrow, and somehow they've made their way onto the Sunday programs. So how is it possible that they now, tomorrow, will outnumber the Republicans? Is it because it's something that he wants? Is it because it's something that he wants to push? And that's what's so embarrassing about it. Just as Keith Olbermann just shot him down. Bernie Sanders basically laid it out. This is not thing about, the left rebelling for no reason or not understanding or not coming. They are going to shove this temporary tax, Social Security tax write-off down his throat and cower him into a corner to make it permanent, to extend it. He has absolutely nothing to stand on.
My question is there another corner? We're going to go to our phone. 720, you're on the air. I respect you. Thank you for your call.
Well, hello, Janice. It's Stephen C. from the mountains.
Stephen C. from the mountains.
From the mountains.
No longer from the ATL.
Right. And I think I want to go up in the mountains and hide forever. I mean, this is insanity. You know, and I couldn't believe I saw Bernie Sanders on CNN today, and one of the people there, I forget who it was one of the women.
Mary Landrieu.
No. One of the reporters from CNN. And she just had this dismissive attitude towards Bernie. He said something like, I got all 800 letters and stuff. And she goes, well, you know, but you're in Vermont, you know, with this like, you know, that doesn't count.
All of a sudden, the independent in the Senate doesn't matter.
Right. He doesn't matter. The people in Vermont, they don't reflect the rest of the country, where they're just all weirdos anyway. I mean, that was her implication. And the thing that riles me up the most is that our president has bought totally into the right wing dialogue. I mean, he's talking about, well, if we don't, you know, do this now, then January 1st, all these people are going to have their taxes go up. We don't. The taxes going up January 1st isn't going to affect anybody till the following April 15th. So he's got plenty of time to make any changes, you know. So if it takes a little longer, you can make them retroactive. You know, I mean, there's no big deadline that all of a sudden poor people are going to be, you know, paying out money. And the thing is, with everybody unemployed or underemployed, you know, a little bit of a reduction in our taxes, who's paying taxes if you're not working? You know, I mean, it's like he's again ignoring the big picture and not seeing the forest for the trees. Like with the stimulus bill, the first one, he didn't really address foreclosures. So we've had millions of more people losing their houses because
mm-hmm.
that didn't address it. It didn't address infrastructure,
yep,
as this one,
mortgage,
too.
The mortgage guarantees have gone on the defensive, and they are, despite the robo-signers, they are foreclosing.
Yes.
There
and not just foreclosing.
No
help. Back in there attacking the lawyers. And filing
right.
suit against the lawyers and charging them with slander and charging them with misrepresentation. They are suing the lawyers who have put out the truth. And, you know, Stephen, you mentioned the you made mention of the not just the 99ers, but you were speaking about – oh, I've lost my train of thought.
About, you know, people unemployed aren't paying taxes anyway. And then what about all the millions of people like me who are self-employed, so I'm out of work, I don't get anything, you know? I mean, and Obama was saying, well, if we don't renew the unemployment, you know, at least we got a little bit of an extension, although it's half as much as the one, you know, that's paying the rich people more money.
Mm-hmm.
And he acted as if, mm-hmm. well, if it didn't happen right now, all these people would be in the streets immediately. I mean, there's a lot of people that are living without unemployment checks, you know. So if it
mm-hmm.
if it took a month longer, it's like Ed Schultz keeps talking about the fact that no one's asked to make any sacrifices, you know. And when I think back to the civil rights movement, when Martin Luther King did a bus strike, there was a whole lot of poor working people that couldn't get to work for however long the strike was, but they were willing to sacrifice to get a higher goal, you know, and
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
and boycotts and shutdowns and stuff weren't, you know, they weren't cost free. And then people went to jail and people had to pay bail and they had to deal with all that. You know, I mean, it's like Obama sounds like he's saving humanity by making this deal with the devil, and he's giving compromise a whole different definition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No,
he worked on the worst-case scenario before he worked on anything else.
Right.
The other is that he has, as Alpha pointed out, as Keith Oberman points out, he has literally begun the compromise process and decision before he began the negotiation
exactly.
and the strategic implementation part of this. The other is we've got to think, you know, he didn't call me and ask me whether I wanted him to do this or not.
Right.
And I'm really behind Keith Oberman asking, hello, who did you talk to?
Well, here's the topper. Just as he has said that he couldn't allow the hostages to be harmed. Well, when you start talking about the taxes going up, and Alan Grayson pointed this out when he was being interviewed by Lawrence O'Donnell. He is the president. He has the power to go to the IRS and tell the IRS to keep the rates as they are.
Right.
Alpha, you keep saying that, you keep reiterating that, you've been talking about that all day today. Barack Obama is not even calling the energy department to tell them what to do about BP neglecting their obligations that they made in regard to the cleanup of the Gulf. So you know he's not going to be calling the IRS. What you up there in Chicago smoking?
But they warned
Californians if they voted to legalize pot that the feds were going to crack down and arrest them even though it was legal there.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, it's and how could he get on TV today? He got on TV today and challenged anybody to say what campaign promise have I not followed through on, or at least tried to do, you know, which gave him a little out there. But what about the campaign promise to not raise, you know, to not let the tax cut of the rich be renewed? You know, I mean, what he could do is just let them expire, and then I think what people are forgetting, especially the pundits on TV, is that in the interim during Christmas break, all these Republican senators and congressmen, they have people in their districts that are out of work and that are having their houses foreclosed upon, and they're gonna be telling them, you know, how they feel, you know, because it's like Bernie Sanders is like the little kid that called out the emperor for not wearing new clothes. You know, I mean, it's interesting that it seems that now we've flipped the script, and now it's like older people who are the sole voices of sanity. I mean, you know, before the Iraq War, it was, who was it? That guy, you know, the old Ku Klanman, you know, what was his name, Bob? I forget his name. You know, he was standing in the Senate blasting, you know, going off to Iraq, and now
Bob,
we got Bernie Sanders. Bob who?
Bob Barr. Barr.
Oh, no, it wasn't Bob.
He just died. He just died, the senator, Byrd.
The senator Robert, from the Senate.
Byrd.
Robert
Byrd. Robert Byrd.
Right.
From Virginia.
Right. Right. I mean, he was
Virginia.
Speaking, and it was weird. I mean, him and actually Pat Buchanan was all against going to Iraq, too, but for I guess maybe the same reasons. Even Bush's father was against it, but he wouldn't say it.
Yeah.
So
let's hear while we have you on the line. Let's hear a little bit more about what Keith Olbermann had to say, because I think that he summarized it all.
This president negotiates down from a position of strength better than any politician in our recent history. It is too late now to go back and ask why the president and why the wobbly Democratic leadership whiffed on their chance to force John Boehner to put his money where his mouth was. In September, Boehner said if he had no other option, of course he would vote to extend tax breaks only for the middle class. So the president and the Democrats gave him another option, naturally. But didn't extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy become necessary to get Republican support for extending the jobless benefits? Nonsense. Five times in the last 2 years, Republicans have gone along with extending those jobless benefits, and they've done it without being bribed with tax cuts for the rich. Even now, Boehner's September confession and the GOP's unwillingness to take the blame for killing off jobless benefits offered an alternative blueprint for this president. Let the law expire as scheduled in 24 days. Let all the tax breaks go. And when the Republicans take over the House and try to pass them anew, if they are somehow not stopped in the Senate, veto anything that does not keep tax cuts to the middle class and unemployment benefits as the dog and perks for the rich as the tail. The GOP is still terrified of being blamed for cutting off the unemployed. You take that fact and you break them with it. There's only one possible rational explanation for this irrational and childish transaction. There are Republicans and Tea Partiers who are still intent on cutting off their noses despite their faces. The blind rage conservatives, for whom any compromise is disaster, just as for this president, apparently no compromise is disaster. Maybe the reason the administration's numbers don't really add up in this deal is that the administration was too busy instead counting votes, and there really are enough on the far right to sink it, and the president winds up having his cake and eating it too. He proposed what he can call a tax compromise, and then he can have it derailed publicly and embarrassingly by the Republicans. Maybe the political calculus here exceeds both in priority and quality the real calculus. But I deeply doubt it. Yesterday I had an exchange with a very senior member of this administration who wanted to sell me on this deal. I pointed out that that was fine, except that, as I phrased it to him, frankly, the base has just vanished. Well, he replied, then they must not have read the details. There, in a nutshell, is this administration. They didn't make a bad deal. We just don't understand it. Just as it was our fault, Mr. President, for not understanding your refusal of even the most perfunctory of investigations of rendition or domestic spying or the other crimes of the Bush administration, or why you have now established for those future administrations who want to repeat those crimes that the punishment for them will be nothing. Just as it was our fault, Mr. President, for not understanding Afghanistan. Just as we didn't correctly perceive, sir, the necessity for the continuation of Gitmo. Or how we failed to intuit, President Obama, your preemptive abandonment of single payer in the public option. Or how we could not have foreseen your foot dragging on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Just as we shouldn't have gotten you angry at your news conference today and made all the moderate Democrats wonder why in the hell you get publicly angry so often at the liberals who campaigned for you and whether you might save just a touch of that sarcasm and the self-martyrdom for the Republicans. And of course, Mr. President, we totally betrayed your administration by not concluding our prayers every night, by saying, thank you for preventing another Great Depression. You are entitled to skate along on your own wonderfulness indefinitely. And if you get less than you could have on health care reform or taxes, well, that'll be okay. We're happy to pay $10,000 for a $300 car because, hey, it could have been $20,000, right? And because we only expect you to do one thing correctly during a presidency, and you know you had pretty much cleared that obligation when it proved that you were indeed not John McCain. We're very sorry. In some sense, the senior member's remark about how we did not read the details is not utterly absurd. We have enabled this president and his compromises spinning within compromises, and now there are finally those within his own party who has had enough. In the Senate, the independent Mr. Sanders has threatened to filibuster this deal. He deserves the support of every American in doing so, as do Mr. Hoyer and Mr. Conyers and the others in the House. It is not disloyalty to the Democratic Party to tell a Democratic president he is wrong. It is not disloyalty to tell him he is goddamned wrong. It is not disloyalty for the 99ers and the 99ers-to-be to rally in the streets of Washington. It is not disloyalty to remind the president that he was elected by people to whom he had given a clear outline of what he would do for them. And if he does not steer out of the skid of what he is doing to them, he will not only not be reelected, he may not even be renominated. It is not disloyalty to remind him that we are not bound to an individual. We are bound to principles. If the individual changes or fails often and needlessly, then we get a new man or woman. None of that is disloyalty. It is self-defense. It is the acknowledgement that, as my hero Thurber wrote, you might as well fall flat on your face as lean over too far backward. That is what the base is saying to this president about his presidency. Well, then, we must not have read the details. The Churchill quotation, as opposed to the quotation from that very senior member of your administration, Mr. President, is from October 5th of 1938. I don't want to make any true comparison to the historical event to which it related. The viewer can go ahead and look it up if they wish. I will confess I won't fight if anybody wants to draw a comparison between what you've done with our domestic policies of our day to what Neville Chamberlain did with the international politics of his. But the rest of what Churchill said, paraphrased, but only slightly paraphrased, bears repeating again. The terrible words have, for the time being, been pronounced against this administration. Thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. And do not suppose that this is the end. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip of a bitter cup which will be proffered to us year by year unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and political vigor we arise again and take our stand for what is right. Good night and good luck.
And there you have it. I don't think that there is any president, Stephen, in recent history, including George W. Bush, who has been so publicly flagged.
Well, LBJ.
Well,
I mean, in the 60s, and he did some good. I mean, he was basically a pretty good president until he just stepped in it in Vietnam. I mean, you know,
and
I mean,
Vietnam,
that was
you know, this country forgets that Vietnam belonged to John F. Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower.
Right.
It did not belong to Lyndon Johnson. He didn't know what to do with it.
But see, in the same token, he is the one that was, he continued it. In the face of all of the pressure to continue it.
It's like Obama inherited the economy. It wasn't his economy, but he inherited it.
Right.
But it's like what he's doing with it is he's not making
You're
the right moves.
You're right.
Now, what if he came?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what if he came out and said, okay, look, you know, we're going to put all, take this all this money that was going to go to the wealthy people for job creation, and if that's really what it was for, then you Republicans shouldn't mind me creating jobs with this money and hiring only people that are on unemployment to rebuild infrastructure. And then directly jobs are going to be created from the money that was going to go to the rich people that they all say was going to create jobs anyway. And then how could they argue against that?
Easy.
Of course they would.
Easy, they can tell another lie.
Right. All right, well, thank you very much, Janice and Alpho. Enjoying the show.
Thank you, Stephen.
Have a good
for
week.
For your input. And, you know, and Stephen has been consistently supportive of this president. We've got 10 more minutes, and we're going to go to 610. Thank you. I respect you for your call. I respect you because you are who you are, but thank you for your call.
And thank
good
you.
Evening.
Thank you for being there.
Brother Brock.
Brother Brock, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, right outside Philadelphia. Good day to you and yours.
How are you?
Doing fine. As I once again tune in, listen to some outstanding coverage to the brother, the call who just got off, and the people in the chat room. First, let me, I'm going to make it brief. I know it's winding down. Thank you so much for the author that came on today, and with your reference, I will go out and get the first of the trilogy. I wish I'd known earlier because I was at the Black-owned bookstore right here where I live, Yaden, right outside of Philadelphia. Brought about the
It's not in the bookstores yet. You would have to go to Amazon.
Yeah, I understand, but I wish.
Mm-hmm.
Too many times I listen to different authors. They always go to the big run stores to get sell their books. But the small fry, the mom and pop stores, and that's where I always go first. And if they don't have it, then I'll go to the other store. So I went to my mom and pop store and got $60 worth of books a day. So
I would suggest to all of you, in support of solid, scholarly, enjoyable literature, to go to your independent bookstores and ask them to carry this book. Thank you,
yep.
Brother Brock. That's a great idea. What are you going to do about your president?
I kind of want to let him loose. I'm not really, you know, I don't want to just drink the water like I mentioned earlier today. I'm in a whole room of people last night at a party, Christmas party, and they were just drinking the water blindly. And I was like, well, at least I'm the one in this room that collects unemployment, and at least I'm the one who should be the happiest because he extended it, but I'm the one who's upset.
Yeah,
and I'm ready to cut off my own nose.
Overall, it's not good public policy.
Yeah, and that's the deal, overall.
Yeah.
So if we can look past,
yep.
You know, I always tell people, just like my elders told me, don't just look at the corner of a picture frame. Look at the whole picture. Get the whole view of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you look further down the road, then it's an ugly picture. But if you're just talking about getting a couple dollars to help pay your rent and maybe get a couple Christmas gifts. And technically, you can't even get Christmas gifts when you get unemployment because that's only half of your normal pay. So it's technically only.
And there is no understanding that over the course of this, if there is a tax increase, even with the tax break, you've got health care and other items in people's daily budgets that are just creeping up. If you think about heating oil, if you think about gasoline for cars, if you think about the cost of food and how it has risen. I know that I'm facing something like a 4.8% increase in health benefits come January 1st. So, you know, we've got to think in terms of all of those things and how this plays out. And the bottom line, Brother Brock, Wealthy people do are not going to spend the money.
Nope. They're
not. They're
going
to
invest
it and put it back on Wall Street and let it sit, because they have the luxury of doing that.
They'll spend it, but it won't be in the community, because if they get a fancy car or a fancy house, that's not with your neighborhood car dealer. It's not with your neighborhood realtor. It's not with your neighborhood bank. So
exactly.
Yeah, we won't.
Exactly.
It won't trickle back into the community at all.
Right.
They'll go where they always go to spend their money. When they
yep.
take a vacation, it's not going to
yep.
be to the regular beach or the shore. It's
yep.
going to be to one of the private places. So we don't get to feel that money.
Well,
we've got to keep
talking at our parties and keep talking to our neighbors and the people that we work with to help them understand what this really is all about. Brother Brock, we've got to run. You always
catch us in
the late hours.
Let me just say my one statement was, I am a member of a COBRA here in Philadelphia. You mentioned that last
wonderful.
Year. Wonderful. We're asking who was, and I go to protests and activists and the whole nine yards. So talk to you soon.
Great
work.
Okay.
Brock.
Thank you, Brother Brock. And in Philadelphia, you've got a lot of really good activism going on. Last Saturday, I was invited to speak in Philadelphia at a fundraiser given by our good brother, James Minor, and I want to shout out to him. He organized on his own a fundraiser in Philadelphia for the Scott Sisters, a legal fund. And Lumumba, who is the attorney for the Scott Sisters, was able to attend, and I just want to shout out to him. I also want to thank Stephen C. and Brother Brock for their very insightful. There are people who are not sleepers, and our Common Ground audience and callers are people who are not sleepers, and we've got to wake other people up. Before we go, I do want to acknowledge the death of our brother and wonderful musician, saxophonist, James Moody, one of my favorite. I'm sure that Stephen C. joins me in the chat room, who is also one of his fans. I have been a fan of his since I was very, very young, and we want to just shout out to James Moody and say, rest in the groove, brother. He is now an ancestor. The other thing that I do want to tell you, two announcements, listen up very carefully. Next Saturday, Nina Freelorn, the jazz vocalist, will be with us here at Our Common Ground. She has a new album, and for those of you who have been following Our Common Ground, you know that Pierce Freelon, the hip-hop artist, is her son, and he will be with us as well. And we want to send out our prayers and bands of angels to Aretha Franklin as she faces this very, very serious illness, and hope that she will recover and her treatment is successful. And for all of you who are coming into both the Christmas and the Kwanzaa season, we want to encourage you to enjoy it, to love and love more and love some more. Alpha, thank you so much for being with us again here at Our Common Ground. And we'll see you all this week, every night, Our Common Ground, 8:30 p.m. with Dr. Deborah. We're going to be talking about children and prison. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you so much, Stephen Seed, Brother Brock, for your calls. A special thanks to Jamal Ali. Have a great Sunday.
For being with us here tonight at Our Common Ground.
And we want to thank the author, Jamal Ali, for joining us in our discussion of his new trilogy, The Heart Fire Rendezvous. Three books, Ancient Memories, Ancient Selves. We hope that you will enjoy this book and give it as gifting during the Kwanzaa season. Purchase your copies of this wonderful, intriguing story at heartfirerendezvous.com. We want to thank our callers, and I want to thank Alzo for co-hosting with me tonight. We'll see you right here at Our Common Ground next Saturday night, 10 p.m., speaking truth to power and ourselves.